Well, good morning. My name is AJ Poularens. I am, what I said, like I'm an astronomer, but I work at Anselm House. If you've never heard of Anselm House, we are a Christian study center at University of Minnesota. So in the Twin Cities, so an hour and a half away from here. What we do is we engage Christian faculty and Christian students in their studies to pursue wholeness. So a lot of Christians, right, when you go to the university, a lot of people feel lonely, feel a little bit isolated. So there's campus ministries, obviously, that people are associated with, like the varsity, crew, navigators, all of those kind of organizations, RUF. And those are great, but many of those organizations, they provide Bible study, they provide training, discipleship, and those different kind of things, but they do not provide this integration of faith and learning. And that's where Christian study centers come in, and so we kind of try to do that. We kind of try to bring those two worlds together so that students are able to bring their faith and their learning together. And not only students, but also Christian faculty. So that's what I'm doing. I'm an astrophysicist, so that's what my background is. After I got my PhD in astrophysics, actually during my time that I got my PhD in astrophysics, so I was a grad student, I became deeply interested in kind of exploring this intersection between faith and learning. And at that time, it was for me faith, science and faith, right? So as a scientist, so science and faith. So I was in the Netherlands at that time. That's where I grew up. So that's where my accent is from as well, if you were wondering about that. I was in the Netherlands and trying to explore those kind of things. And I actually found a lot of good resources to be able to do those kind of things. A lot of apologetics books. Not working. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. A lot of apologetics books, a lot of like kind of biblical theology sources to kind of really think through kind of what does the Bible say about certain things. But I noticed for myself that even though I went through Christian elementary school and high school and things like that, that I didn't really have the resources to really do it well. So the way that I often explain it now to kind of like the faculty that I work with is like as a faculty member, you have basically been able to grow academically to really, really high levels. You're an expert in your field. Theologically, you haven't grown as much. Yeah. So basically what happens is if you, for example, do your master's or your PhD at a big public school, then you don't really get any faith formation. You don't get any kind of like way of kind of like integrating those two things. So what happens for a lot of kind of Christian academics is that they kind of stay stuck somewhere. So basically the theological and philosophical understanding, so the faith is vibrant, right? So nothing against people's faith, but the theological and philosophical kind of depth of the faith stays somewhere here while their scholarship goes somewhere here. And so what we try to do at Anselm House and at lots of other Christian study centers at universities is bring their faith and like their understanding, their reflection on their faith, so theological and philosophical ideas, up to this level so that you can actually bring them together again and have this conversation between faith and scholarship. I found it for myself really, really difficult to do as well. And so that's why I went to seminary. So after I got my PhD in physics or astrophysics, I actually went to Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis for 4 years. And studied the Bible there. And it was incredibly helpful because a lot of different things that I didn't know, I got there. So a much deeper understanding of theology, much deeper understanding of the biblical storyline. And then also I got philosophical tools, even though it was a seminary and not a philosophy school or department, I got like lots and lots of different tools to basically be able to kind of like dive deeper into those kind of things. So after I did that, I still was not at the level, basically, where I was able to bring them together. And I still am not. Like, I don't think you ever are really, like, conversant between the two fields fully, like, where they're exactly at the same level. Unless you do two PhDs, one in philosophy, one in theology, and one in your field. But no one does that, or hardly anyone does that. Anyway, so what I was able to do after that, after I finished seminary, I didn't go into pastoral ministry. I actually went teaching at a Christian college. So the Christian college, what you see at a Christian college is a lot of people and a lot of Christian colleges will really emphasize the integration of faith and learning, right? That's what they're distinct for. Like, they are there to do that integration well. The question is, actually, and the problem is that a lot of Christian colleges just say that they do it, but they don't do it. They don't really know how to do it because the faculty members that come in are indeed educated at secular universities They're experts in the field, but they're not really well developed in their theology and philosophy. So what a lot of Christian colleges then do is a lot of theological and philosophical education for the faculty to kind of bring them up to this level. Because otherwise you get kind of a mismatch. People start like using their scholarship to speak into matters of faith and it goes wrong, or use like the theological ideas to speak into the scholarship and it goes wrong as well. You can do more damage there for the Christian witness and for academia than you can sometimes do at other places if you just keep quiet. So that's what I noticed for myself. So in my time at Wheaton College, where I was for 11 years, I learned how to teach pretty well. But I also learned for myself much better to kind of keep on the trajectory that I started in seminary, to kind of go deeper into the Bible, deeper into philosophy, deeper in theology, and kind of develop that. At the same time, I still feel very inadequate in doing that. Like, I haven't written a book yet. People ask me, like, when are you going to write your first book? And I say, like, well, this is what I said to my wife. Tim Keller didn't write his first like big book that he was well known for, like The Reason for God or something like that, until he was 50. Why is that? I think he needed to mature his thoughts. Obviously, he was very, very busy with like his ministry in New York City and things like that. But there's also a sense in which you need to mature your thoughts before you actually start writing about that. So my excuse is I'm still maturing my thoughts. I'm not 50 yet. I'm not even approaching that yet, even though I've passed 40. But I'm just maturing my thoughts. And eventually there will hopefully come something. That's my excuse. But it's, I think it's a good excuse. Because I do think, and actually have written, or and I've read a lot of books from other people who've tried to do it, where I was a little cringing sometimes. Like, I'm not completely sure that is actually what you're trying to do here is helpful. Anyway, I'm not going to give examples of that because I'm not here to lambast people. I'm here to help you a little bit understand what I think at the moment, as someone who taught at a Christian college for 11 years and now works at a big state school, right, and tries to help other faculty do this, what I think is kind of a helpful approach, where kind of the direction that I've chosen so far. So, integration of faith and learning. I'm going to use my slides that you cannot see, but I can see. Which is a little unfortunate, but it was primarily text on there. There was not a whole lot of pictures on there, so hopefully that will be okay. So the first question is, why would you do it, right? Why would you integrate faith and learning? And it's a big question. So I kind of gave a little bit the idea already, like the kind of the disconnect between faith understanding and scholarship, so to say, and to bring those together. And why did you want to bring them together? Now, one of the phrases that you hear a lot is like, all truth is God's truth, right? So whatever you do here in this earth, on this world, all the truths that you find, whether it's in scholarship or in theological work or just in the normal work that you do each and every day, it is not like there's no secular sacred divide. It's not like some parts belong to God and some parts belong somewhere else. No, everything belongs to God. It's what Abraham Kuyper said like about a century ago. Like, there's not a square inch of which God says it's mine, right? It was a little bit different to quote, and this is the way that most people remember it. The Dutch actually is nicer. It's not a square inch. It has something to do with like a thumb that you press up somewhere on. But that wouldn't... It's really difficult to translate that, but obviously as a Dutch speaker, I know his original quote. So everything falls under the lordship of Christ. So that means also all the scholarship and all the academic knowledge that we know should fall under the lordship of Christ. And so it's worth pursuing. It's not only worth pursuing in its Christian elements, but it's actually worth pursuing bringing them together and deeply together, deeply integrated. The question is, who should do that, obviously? So we'll go a little bit there. But basically, the whole idea is to resist this kind of like fragmentation that you find. You find it in every part of education, right? You find it at like primary schools already, secondary schools. You find it in higher ed as well. This fragmentation where you basically pull those things together. There's neutral facts, like the things that we can kind of research and things like that. And then there's Christian truths. And we kind of like separate those. And I think we should fight against that. All truth is God's truth, and everything should be thought through from a Christian perspective. Now, some of that is easier to say than others, and we'll also dive a little bit more into that. So, what is then faith and learning integration? I had a couple of definitions that I was going to put on here that you will be able to read then. It's always difficult. Like, if I give you like a quote right here, like probably 50% goes totally past you, but I'm still going to do it. This is a definition by Elizabeth Hall, who teaches at Biola, so a big Christian college at the West Coast. Christian scholarship refers to a variety of ways in which Christians who hold to the underlying unity of truth in a world created by God through Jesus Christ strive to bring together the character, the convictions, the practices as shaped by their faith and their academic disciplines. Yeah, so it's basically bringing not only like knowledge, but also practices, convictions, identity, character, all those different kind of things together. So that's a really broad definition of like what faith and learning integration could be. I'm not going to explore all of those because that would be too much. This is William Hasker in a journal called Christian Scholars Review, read by a lot of Christian scholars at universities, Christian colleges and universities. This is what he says: a scholarly project whose goal is to ascertain and to develop integral relationships which exist between a Christian faith and human knowledge, particularly as expressed in various academic disciplines. So you see kind of like this kind of dichotomy almost. There's human knowledge right here, and then there's Christian faith. He tried to bring them together. Yeah, so that's basically what he says. And he says it's a scholarly project. It's not for everyone. Not everyone has to do this, but academics should kind of like pursue some of this. So that's then the question, like, who should do this, right? And so, first of all, I would say, like, everyone, right? So there's a sense that everyone should live a whole life. And no one should live a divided life, where there's, like, certain areas where God doesn't have, like, a say over and areas where God does have a say over. Or some areas where your faith is really important to you and other areas where faith is not important. Everyone should have an whole life, right? A life of unity. So I do think there's a sense in whatever you're doing, you should kind of try to integrate your faith there. But we're talking about education right here, right? And so there's a particular element in which kind of this faith and learning integration is important in the context of Christian and non-Christian education. So, for example, elementary schools, should you do faith and learning integration? I think yes. Right? So you learn a lot of different things in an elementary school. I have like 4 kids in elementary school right now. And so they learn a lot of different things. They're in public schools at the moment. And so they learn a lot of things that actually separate from Christ. Right? So what my wife and I try to do, not fully and not completely and not as much as we probably should do, is but talk with them and engage them. What do you learn? And what does the Bible actually say about this? Yeah? And that's hard. That's hard. And we sometimes worry about that, whether we actually are able to really help them to understand those kind of things. So that's obviously where the Christian school movement comes in, where it is integrated. So who should do it? Well, in a Christian school, it's primarily teachers, and obviously parents should keep tabs on that. If your kids are in private or in public schools, then it's primarily on the parents to do this, right? Because you don't get it at school. So again, but who has the tools for that, right? How do you do those kind of things? Who has the tools for those kind of things? So that's where, like, writers come in, people who actually write about those different kind of things, who think about this. But then you go to secondary education, especially post-secondary education, universities, where basically people will do it, I don't want to say will do it for you, but where scholars will help you. People, for example, who have studied sociology, right? They're like, how do you say that? Like, very well placed to understand their discipline. And then if their faith and their theological reflection has grown enough to reflect on that, and then to help other people understand how does different fields relate together. Yeah, so that makes sense a little bit. So in an academy, whether it's Christian colleges or not Christian colleges, there's a sense in which people who have studied this field in very, very great depth, they're actually able to help other people to think deeper about that. Should they do it for themselves as well? Yes, right? Because they want to live a whole life. So there's a question of audience a little bit. Who's your audience? So for themselves, they should do it, especially if they feel some tension. They could do it for the church. And it also could do it for kind of the world, so to say, for other people who don't believe in Christ yet, to help them understand that maybe the Christian faith gives better answers to certain questions than what kind of a secular scholarship would do. So there's a sense in which, like, at every level of education, you should pursue the scholarship, but there's some people are particularly well placed to help other people to pursue this better. Does that make sense? So, and that would be academics. So there could be Christian academics at Christian colleges who are almost like called to do this kind of work. Could also be Christian academics at non-Christian colleges and universities who will probably find a lot more difficult time to do this, but also are in a position where they sometimes might actually be able to speak into a situation that other people are not able to speak into. So very interesting. And then what I said, like, it requires a level of maturity because you can do more damage sometimes if you do it wrong than if you do it correct. So but I sometimes say to people have said it to me, like, AJ, just wait with publishing on this kind of stuff. And that was wise advice. They also said, like, don't do it. And I said, like, that's not wise advice. So when I was at Wheaton, I got some comments from other faculty saying, like, why don't you, like, wait with this faith and learning stuff until kind of like until you have tenure? And I said, like, no, I need to do it now. Right? This is the time already where I need to do it. But I think it was wise advice from them to say, like, why don't you wait publishing with this kind of stuff until you have tenure, right? When you're a little bit more established and that kind of stuff, and a little bit more mature. Well, I still haven't published anything, so, but that is a different reason. That's for the maturity reason. Okay, so what is it not? That's a big question, right? So here's a couple of things. If you think about faith and learning, it is not the cultivation of a personal Christian living on the part of a faculty member or an academic. So it's not like an, how do you say that? Like a cultivation of like the Christian practices and things like that for someone who's pursuing this. It's an intellectual thing, most of it. It's also not using academic disciplines as a source of illustration for spiritual truths. I've seen this done in very cringy ways, so to say. So I'll give an example. I'm a physicist, or an astrophysicist. So quantum mechanics is a field that I'm supposed to know. I'm not so good at quantum mechanics because it's really, really difficult. But the quantum mechanics is a really interesting field, emerged about 100 years ago. And it's this idea that the way that we describe like matter, like atoms, is not deterministic, but it's probabilistic, which basically means like there's a lot of kind of like probabilities that play a role there. And it looks like contradictions, but they're not in terms of like physics. So here's one example. For example, an electron, so a really, really small particle, according to classical physics, can only be at one place at a certain time and not at other places. So there's only one place where that particle can be. In quantum mechanics, it can be anywhere. But you describe a probability to that electron. In some places there's more chance or a higher chance for the particle to be, and other places a lower chance for the particle to be. But no one knows where that particle is. Another one would be, for example, light. So light can be described both as a wave, as most of you probably have learned in some physics classes here and there, or it can be described as a particle, yeah, photon. So what is it? Well, no one knows. Yeah. So at certain places and certain times in physics, you would treat light as a particle, and a lot of places and times you would treat it as a wave. But you cannot say light is a wave because it can also be a particle. You can also just not definitely say light is a particle because it can also be described as a wave. And a particle and a wave is not the same. So what I've heard people are saying then, well, this duality between wave and particle is similar to how Jesus was. Right, Jesus was both man and God. And so we have like this duality between God and man in Jesus Christ. And that's very similar then to the way that we have this duality between light and particles. It's not. So you cannot use an illustration from physics where you find something that looks a little bit the same, smells maybe a little bit the same, and then try to apply that to kind of like theological truths. It goes really, really wrong. But I've seen that, like I've seen it in books, I've seen it in lectures, and I was like, no, that's not the way that you do the integration of faith and learning. It's also not a public relations program to convince like your students and parents and alumni that you still are very, very Christian and things like that. And it's not a quick fix to take your scholarship and then put a Christian sauce over it and say, like, I'm actually doing integration of faith and learning, something like that. So what is it then? What is it then? Is it apologetics? Yeah, sometimes yes and sometimes no. So that's also like, It's not a duality. it is a relationship of apologetics, but not necessarily. So here we go. The big question, if you want to think about like faith and learning, is first of all, who do you want to do it for? Yeah? And so what I basically always say is there's like three different audiences. There's the audience of self, there's the audience of the church and Christians, other Christians, and there's the audience of kind of the world, or like academia, or like, you get it, right? Like the wider kind of culture. So why would you do it for yourself? So I think the main argument to do it for yourself is to relieve some of the tension that you might feel. So for example, when I was studying astrophysics, I felt a lot of tension between my Christian convictions and between what I learned in the classroom. And so when I was in college, my second and third and fourth year of my education, I went actually for a period of very, very serious doubt, really questioning a lot of the Christian kind of like the Christian doctrine and questioning my own faith. And I would say, almost say, like almost losing my faith for a while. By God's grace, I got through that, but it didn't mean that the tension was relieved. And so then I started really pursuing those kind of questions. Like, what does it mean then for me to be a Christian astrophysicist or be an astrophysicist and Christian? And where are the points of tension that I experience? And how do I resolve those points of tension? So I didn't talk with anyone about it. I didn't give lectures on that. I didn't write books on that. I just pursued those questions for myself because I felt tension in myself. And I think a lot of people, whether you teach at like elementary school level, maybe not so much, but like middle school, high school level, where you kind of get into kind of the deeper topics, and certainly in higher education and beyond that, right, wherever you are, whatever stage of life you are, you might experience some of those tensions between what people say is scholarship and between your Christian faith. And to pursue that and to kind of go deeper into that is one way of like faith and learning integration. Right? So there's certainly an area where I think it's totally legitimate not to have any audience in front of you, but just do it for yourself to relieve some of those tension, to pursue wholeness. So explore areas of doubt as well and go deeper into those kind of things. Explore what you actually believe. So it's actually sometimes really an opportunity to dive deeper into your own personal beliefs. Like, what do I really believe about creation? What do I really believe about who we are as human beings? What do I really believe about, like, what is the solution to the problems in this world? Those are big questions. And so to kind of like pursue those kind of questions in a very systematic way is actually faith and learning integration. Hopefully you can bless someone else with that as well, right? Don't keep it for yourself, all by yourself. But maybe you can talk with your kids. Maybe you can talk with friends. Maybe you can talk with people in church about those kind of questions that you're pursuing. And maybe you can find some other people to go on the journey with you. Right? Don't, like, sometimes you do it by yourself, but it's sometimes very helpful to actually pursue this journey with other people in a discussion group, book readings or whatsoever. So there's a sense in which, like, it really opens you up to kind of explore theological and also philosophical kind of depth, and to kind of really kind of like answer those questions for yourself. And to a certain extent, I would say that kind of like pursuing a depth in theology and philosophy is a prerequisite to go to the next step, right? To basically go and like talk with other people about it. Maybe not in a book discussion group, but if you, for example, if your church asks you to teach a Sunday school class on science and faith, don't do it if you don't have like a good understanding of where you are yourself. But if you feel like a little bit more at a place where you think like, yeah, I can share, then please go out because people need it, right? So then the next audience would be kind of church and Christian organizations, Christian scholars, all of that. And I in my preparation for this whole thing, someone called this maximal integration. Yeah? So maximal integration. Why maximal? Because this is the place where you can go as deep and far and wide as you want. Right? There's no constraints, there's no boundaries, especially not of like secular academia, so to say. Right? In academia, you need to be careful, you need to be strategic in what you're going to say. In a church, you can go as deep as you can in exploring basically how faith relates to a certain field. So maximal integration. And that's actually really, really cool. So I've done this for many, many years, speaking at student conferences for InterVarsity, speaking at Libri. At Wheaton College, I was able to pursue this as far and wide as I wanted it for myself, because there is no constraints in kind of, like, obviously heresy is a constraint, you don't want to go there, but there's no, not like that you cannot go, like, you can pursue all kind of rabbit trails if you want to. So what do you focus on when you focus on kind of like faith and learning integration in a Christian context? Now, one of them would be kind of theology, right? Theology, kind of like theological questions. What are like the deepest kind of like principles, Christian principles, and how does it actually influence the way that we think about this world? That would be one, kind of deep theological and philosophical questions. Another one would be kind of applied and ethical questions. So what do I mean with that? So applied questions, let's go for so ethical questions first, because it's a little easier, because that's where Christian faith comes in pretty quickly again. So obviously Christian faith provides a moral framework for how we are to behave in this world and what kind of choices we should make. Put that against like what you see in kind of scholarship, and you can kind of like say like, okay, this is where the faith can actually inform certain choices that I'm making, right? Does it make sense? So ethical questions, when it comes, for example, to kind of all kind of medical things, that's where it's not easy, but that's actually where you can really use your Christian faith to inform you about what kind of like decisions you can make, and how you should think about certain treatment plans and all those different kind of things when it comes to medical things. Applied questions would be more, for example, say global warming, right? Big issue. In the sciences right now, climate change, and so you can pursue all kind of questions in global warming and climate change and ecology and those different kind of things. Like, how would the Christian faith talk about sustainable food growing, so to say, or sustainable like agriculture? That's basically the word I was looking for. What does the Christian faith say about like animal farming and how to do those kind of things? What does the Christian faith say about like traffic and car, the use of cars and energy sources and all those different kind of things? So they're very applied questions. But if you believe that the Christian faith speaks to all of life, then you should use your Christian faith to inform those kind of questions and start thinking about those kind of things. It's not enough to say, well, this world is going to burn up anyway, so we can just keep going, right? I've heard people say that. I don't think that is a Christian answer. The Christian answer would be more like, we are created by God in his image, and we have a mandate to steward this world, right? And it basically means to take care of this world in all its aspects. And it means like the fossil fuel resources and things like that, but it also means like the whole ecosystem that we are in here, and that is actually being destroyed by those different kind of things. So there's a sense in which you need to be a steward. That's a balancing act. Right, it's not easy, but there's a lot of questions that you can pursue there as a Christian scholar. Instead of walking away from them, you should actually pursue them, because that's what I think and that's what I believe, that's what God actually calls us to do. It's difficult in Christian circles, right? Because in Christian circles, people don't want to talk about those kind of things a lot. Or the answers are kind of ready-made and given to you already by some Christian pundits on kind of media and that kind of stuff. And we just follow that, right? But I think to have a critical attitude towards some of those kind of, I don't want to call them mainstream, but Christian mainstream ideas, is actually that you're willing to pursue those kind of things and go deeper into them and actually say, like, actually, what really does the Bible say about this? So it's not sufficient to say, like, well, America has always been energy self-sufficient, so we just need to keep investing in coal and gas and that kind of stuff. That's not a Christian answer. Christian answer would go much deeper in going, really exploring, like, what is God's creation? What is our task there? What are the resources that God has given us? What is our task there? And how do we balance those different kind of things, especially in kind of like the reality of climate change? So that's kind of a deep integration. It's a lot of work. It's not a simple answer. It's not something that you just hear on kind of like the media and on the news or like some Christian books or whatsoever. This really involves all sources of kind of knowledge that are relevant to this thing. Philosophical, theological, and then kind of like other things like disciplinary questions. Bring them together and go much deeper and deeper into that. The last one that I want to highlight is what Tim Keller calls high theory, and what Chris Watkin calls, and don't shudder by this, critical theory. Yeah, so here's an Here's a book that just came out a couple of weeks ago. Maybe some of you heard about it, maybe some of you have not heard about this. It's called Biblical Critical Theory. Well, don't compare this with race theory, right? That's a whole other topic. There's some overlap there. But basically what Christopher Watkin is doing here, he actually says the biblical story has something to say about every question in life. And how are we going to do that? Yeah. So the subtitle is How the Bible's Unfolding Story Makes Sense of Modern Life and Culture. This is probably one of the most important books. I've not read it. I'm this far in. This is probably one of the most important books that has been written over the last 10 years. Yeah. And so if you're interested in philosophy, theology, and culture, and the intersection of those different kind of things, I would highly recommend it. It's not an easy read. 700 pages, I think. But the work that he's doing here is so important for Christian scholars, for Christians in general, to really dive deeply into it. So he basically says, he says, I am going to walk through the Christian story, from creation all the way to redemption. I'm going to see what kind of the basic ideas that I can derive from the Christian story and how they apply to modern life as we know it right now. And his basic premise is that what you often see both in academia and in kind of in life itself is that people go to two extremes, either this or that. And he says often, so it's either modernism or postmodernism, right? So sometimes people say liberal or conservative or this or that and that kind of stuff. He says actually often the Bible brings those two things together in a very different and much more radical way. And so he explores those kind of things. So biblical critical theory, Tim Keller called it high theory, but he has now been convinced by Chris Watkin that he actually should call it critical theory. So using the light of the Bible to shine upon all kind of different things. So what does he do? He actually explores and exposes the presuppositions under a lot of different ideas and cultural ideas and things like that, and scientific ideas in our contemporary culture and society. And he explores them, and then he tries to figure out, what does the Bible say about this? This is amazing, this book. So if you haven't seen it yet, I have no idea whether it's on the table. I should have recommended it. But is it on the table? Yeah? Okay. So it's an important book. On the corner, okay. So it's kind of going deep into those presuppositions, kind of the underlying ideas in our current culture, and then kind of shining the light of the Bible on that. And this is, I think, a rich resource for people working in any field. Yeah, so for me as a physicist, there's a lot of different things there that I can take, but not everything. For a sociologist, a lot of different things, but not everything. For an economist, I don't know. For a painter, there's a lot of things that you can probably take out of there. It's more like how would you say that? Almost like the first kind of episode of something that hopefully will start flourishing in all kind of different directions. So there's maybe the trunk of the tree, and then he hopes that this is being taken up by lots of different people and then explored and developed in all kind of different areas. So why would you do this for a Christian audience? This maximal integration. You understand God's reality more deeply. You understand God's involvement more deeply. And you understand God's agenda for human flourishing more deeply. So lots of different kind of areas, basically all the big questions in life, all the big issues in current culture, and understanding yourself deeper. I think it's worth it, right? To do it for yourself and then to do it for the church, this maximal integration. Again, it's not easy. You do need some theological knowledge, so you do need some philosophical knowledge to be able to do this well, but it's certainly worth it. And then for Christian scholars, people working at Christian universities and colleges, I think almost I don't want to say the mandate is, but publish it, right? So publish it, so disseminate it. Don't keep it for yourself, don't keep it in your academic circles, but write books then that are actually accessible for Christians throughout all culture, throughout the church especially. So, for example, one of my friends, Gavin Ortlund, I don't know whether you've heard of him. He is a theologian, but deeply acquainted with all kinds of different things. He wrote a book, Why God Makes Sense in a World That Doesn't, exploring actually themes in the sciences. Very, very interesting and fascinating. So he is a Christian scholar, a patristic scholar, and he says, I am going to put my scholarship to the service of the church, writing books to help other people understand why they should be a Christian, so to say. So more a little bit an apologetical approach. So this is where apologetics comes in.
What was the title and the author?
Yeah, so Gavin Ortlund. There's hundreds, thousands of books like this. Ortlund, O-R-T-L-U-N-D, Gavin Ortlund. Why God makes sense in a world that doesn't. I would have put this slide, like, I had this in my slides. You could have copied this right down from there, but it doesn't work. Otherwise, you can always come up later. This is a book that someone recommended to me a couple of weeks ago. I was talking to someone, and they said, Believing is Seeing by Michael Gullen. He's a physicist, and so the title is, or the subtitle is, A Physicist Explains How Science Shatters His Atheism and Reveals the Necessity of Faith. So someone who came from atheism, became a Christian, and wrote a book about that. Well, incredibly helpful, probably. I haven't read it yet, but I can see that, right? So that's a Christian scholar who uses his scholarship to basically inform other people, both Christians and non-Christians, I think, to kind of like think deeper about the big questions. The way that you know what kind of the audience is for a book is you look at the blurbs, who has blurbed it. If the blurbs are all Christians, then it's probably for a Christian audience. If the blurbs are also non-Christians, then probably the audience was a little wider and broader. Anyway, here's another one. Stephen Meyer, The Return of the God Hypothesis, kind of like also about science and physics and things like that. Who's this written for? Well, probably for Christians. Again, like if you look at the blurbs right here, but there's also some non-Christians who probably might be interested in something like this, as long as they're open for kind of exploring those questions. So you see a little bit like, especially kind of like helping Christian people, Christian church to understand, to go deeper in those kind of questions, and using this as formation for the church, but then maybe some other people might benefit from that as well. Okay, last one, which is the most difficult one. How do you want to do this for kind of the secular world, right? How do you want to do faith and learning integration? Say you're in a secular context, like where I am right now at the University of Minnesota. Even though I'm not affiliated with the University of Minnesota, I work with a lot of faculty who are at the University of Minnesota. Or Christian scholars at Christian universities and colleges who want to write not just for their field, but also, or not only for like the church, but also for their field. So how do you do this? So here's the thing. This is incredibly difficult. Yeah, because first of all, it's generally not, people don't want to hear it. People not interested in it, people don't want to hear it. There's a sense in which kind of like Christian voices are being suffocated almost. Yeah? But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. Because there's a lot of opportunities, I think, to speak truth into a world that doesn't want to hear the truth. And kind of like help people slowly maybe to see certain things. So this is what the person who called maximal integration, that same person called the strategic integration. Where you're very strategic in the ways that you actually explore those kind of things. So you use the rules of your discourse, this discourse of the secular discipline, but find ways to advance a Christian agenda, is maybe not the right word, but a Christian kind of like understanding of reality to the extent it's allowed to tolerate it by the discipline. So that's one way you can do it. For example, there's like a journal, Psychology of Religion. Yeah? So that basically means people, psychologists, explore the interface between religion and psychology. Now, as a Christian psychologist, it would be very interesting to kind of publish there. It's not going to be easy because it's a secular journal, but there's openness towards certain questions there. Yeah? And so you can kind of explore those kind of things. And there will be opportunities for you to actually, the way that Peter says, that witness about the hope that's within you, right? To kind of sprinkle certain things in there, sprinkle Christian truths in there, so that people who read that might eventually have some, huh, that's interesting, where did you get that from? And maybe start asking questions. So you need to be very strategic. Critical theory, again, something like this, where you kind of expose some of the presuppositions under certain fields and show that there's inconsistencies in those presuppositions. Again, people don't always want to hear that, but there might be openings. For example, in my own field, physics, cosmology, astrophysics. So one of the things that I'm fascinated by is like, what is the origin of the universe? It's not my field, not particularly like the questions that I do research in, but I'm interested in as a Christian. So what do you do then? So I've read a lot of like cosmologists who kind of like write popular books or not popular books about like the origin of the universe. And one of the things that you see there is that people are willing to go deeper and deeper and deeper, ask more and more questions, like where does the universe come from? Well, from the Big Bang. What is the Big Bang? Well, big explosion in the beginning. What is there? Matter, energy. Where does it come from? Well, from the Big Bang. And so you can go deeper and deeper and deeper, and most people eventually realize that there's going to be a limit. They will bump into something. So, for example, one of my I don't want to say favorite cosmologist, but I like him because he's pretty honest in certain things. It's Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll, he was at Stanford. I think he's at Johns Hopkins right now. He is a fairly famous cosmologist. He wrote a book, The Big Picture, where he talks about meaning and life and purpose and origins and things like that. And he actually admits in that book that if you go deeper and deeper and deeper into the questions of cosmology, there's going to be a point where he has to say, like, I don't know the answer and I don't think there is an answer. And he calls that a brute fact. Yeah, so a brute fact. So for him, the very origin of the universe and the very origin of the laws of physics is a brute fact to him. Now that's interesting, right? Because what is a brute fact? It's a fact that has no meaning, has no explanation, and it's just there. Well, what is that? Right, that's certainly not a statement of science anymore. That basically becomes a statement of faith now. Now there's an opening, right? There's an opening to explore those kind of things. Like, does it actually make sense for you as a naturalistic cosmologist to believe in brute facts? That's a very interesting question, and a question that can actually raise some tension in the room when you kind of talk with him about this kind of thing, because people become quite defensive when you kind of push them a little bit on those kind of things. Another one, similar field, kind of mathematics and physics and cosmology, is like, how is it possible that mathematics is able to describe this universe in like differential equations, in very simple terms? Where does that analogy between kind of a very complex world and then very simple mathematics, where does it come from? And there's no real answer for that. So most mathematicians actually are Platonists. So they believe that that mathematics is actually eternal. So that's already the next question. Like, why is it eternal? Where does it come from? Like, is it just there? Like, people just don't know. So that's what most mathematicians believe. So how is something that is eternal, that's Platonic, so to say, how is it possible that it's actually maps so perfectly onto something that's contingent, that has an origin in time? It's a big question, and no one knows. So there's opportunities there for Christian scholars to kind of poke and like kind of explore those questions a little deeper. That's another opportunity there. And I think every field has those kind of like inconsistencies between the worldview and certain things that they believe, so to say. And you can explore those kind of things as a Christian. And then the really big questions. Like the really big questions about, like, is there meaning in life? Is there purpose in life? What does it mean to be a human being? All of those big questions actually have opportunity for Christians and for Christian scholars to speak into that. So, for example, at Anselm House, one of the things that we do is we organize roundtables, university roundtables, where we bring Christian scholars and non-Christian scholars, and actually the majority is non-Christian scholars, together around the table. We give them a really beautiful dinner and some drinks. And then we have generally one or two speakers introducing a certain topic. So last year, we had in the fall, we had someone introducing the topic of flourishing at the university. That's a big thing. A lot of people working at the university right now are not really flourishing, are really burdened by all kind of administrative duties, grant writing, grading, worrying about students who are not paying attention because they're on the phones all the time, and all that kind of stuff. So if you think like being a professor is like a great job, it's actually not so great anymore. And a lot of people actually recognize that and are not flourishing anymore. But you want it, right? You want to flourish at university. So we brought about 70 people together at a really nice place in Minneapolis. And we had like 2 hours long conversations around the table. So first introduced by like those two speakers and then around the table. And we just asked some provocative questions. And it was a great opportunity for our Christian faculty to witness about the hope that's within them. And to kind of bring their scholarship, to bring their ideas to the table and help other people to see that there's actually more in life than just like what they believe. And the vast majority of the people were there, they had some like, can we do this again? When is the next one? Because we don't have those conversations. Like no one, like the university is not doing those conversations about meaning and purpose and the bigger questions in life. So there's a big opportunity for Christians when you start thinking a little deeper to really speak at a deeper level into kind of the university. Maybe not particularly in your field, but in a wider kind of Christian, or in a wider kind of like discourse, so to say. And another one we did was on free will. Is free will still possible in the current time of neuroscience? So a little bit more technical. And it was a fascinating discussion again, where Christians were able to witness about those kind of things. Okay, what are some of the areas where it might be easier to kind of like ask those kind of questions? and bring kind of faith and scholarship together. So this is an idea that I actually not too long ago came across, which is very interesting. I thought about it, but it was never kind of as clear for me. So here's a quote. Religious commitments will have more of an influence in disciplines where religion is explicitly a topic that's studied, obviously, right? As well as disciplines where moral judgments are made. Okay, that makes sense, right? Wherever moral judgments are made, there's immediately an import of kind of like worldview, so to say, where people base their ideas on. And so Christian commitments can immediately kind of like come out there. Here's a quote by Emil Brunner, which is kind of similar in kind of idea, but very interesting. So the nearer anything lies to that center of existence where we are concerned with the whole, that is with man's relationship or with human's relationship to God and the being of the person, the greater is the disturbance of rational knowledge by sin. Yes, do you get that? So as Christians, we believe in sin and what we call the noetic effects of the fall. Right, and so the noetic effects of the fall is not just brokenness in general, but we experience each and every day and suffering and things like that. It also has affected our understanding, our reasoning. Yeah, so our reasoning is not as clear anymore, as pure anymore, as it probably once was, and so we're alienated from God, right? And so our reasoning is not as connected with God anymore as it once was. We're alienated from other people. So we're not as compassionate, we're alienated from creation, and we're alienated from ourselves. That's kind of the four fundamental relationships that I generally use there. So the nearer anything lies to that center of existence where we are concerned with the whole, that is with man's relationship to God and the being of person, the greater disturbance of rational knowledge by sin. Okay, so the more we are concerned with who we are as human beings, right, with kind of questions of the whole, so kind of almost like the more the bigger questions, the greater disturbance of rational knowledge by sin. Or the farther anything lies away from this center, the less disturbance felt and the less difference there is between knowing as a believer or as an unbeliever. So for example, physics, right? So not kind of the big cosmological questions, but for example, like what is matter? How does a wheel rotate? Or those different kind of, the very technical questions. Those are really far away from who we are as human beings, right? And so those questions are not as affected by kind of like this noetic effect of the fall, as like questions of who we are in human relationships, who we are in a relationship with God, who we are in a relationship with creation, and who we are in a relationship with ourselves. Makes sense? So whatever is affected by sin deeper, so to say, the noetic effects of the fall, has also more opportunity for Christians to kind of speak into those kind of things. So I don't think that physics has changed as a result of the fall. Yeah? That makes sense? So I don't think physics itself has changed as a result of the fall, but I do think human relationships have changed as a result of the fall. So where is it easy for Christians to speak into? Well, human relationships. And it's not as easy to speak into physics or chemistry, something like that. That makes sense? Yeah? So that's basically what Brunner says. So there's opportunities there. But when it comes to origin questions, right, in cosmology and in biology and like neuroscience, who we are as human beings, there we are concerned with the whole again, right? And so we are affected again. So there's some opportunities. Where would it be easy for Christians to speak in, and where is it not so easy for Christians to speak in? Well, it depends a little bit where kind of the fall has been more kind of heavily affected, those different kind of fields. Okay, I am going to ask a couple of questions here to kind of show, and this is where I wish that we had like the slides, a couple of questions where I think it would be helpful where you can actually pursue this integration of faith and knowledge. It's a little bit philosophical every now and then. But here it is. There's six big categories. One is the category of ontology. Do you know what ontology is? It basically means what is real? What is in this reality? And so the way that we think about what is real in this world is a really big question, right? So for example, a naturalist thinks that what is real in this world is just matter, just this kind of stuff. So Christian, we think there's actually more than matter, right? We believe in a transcendent world. So there's opportunities for Christians then to help other people to understand in the field of ontology, so to say, with the deepest belief about the nature of reality, and to speak into those kind of things. So pursue integration of faith and learning there. What kind of assumptions do you make about what human beings are, for example. That would be also ontology, or on the nature of reality, all those different kind of things. Second question is, actually, there's more anthropology. So what is anthropology? What is a human being? That was my next question. And so there's a very, that's a big question, obviously. A lot of people would look very different to those kind of things, but the Christian faith has something to say about that, right? What is a human being? So what is, for example, in whatever field you are, so for me, physics, how do you think about human beings? Well, in physics, a lot of people think about human beings as just matter, right? Electrical currents and things like that. So there's something that you can challenge there. It's something where you can pursue kind of like, how does the Christian faith speak about this and can bring that together? Ethics, what is right and what is wrong? Right? So big question. Again, so very easy, not easy, but there's a lot of opportunities for Christians to speak into kind of the field of ethics and to kind of talk about like what is right and wrong, or even is there right and wrong, right, on a deeper level. Something that no one will deny that there's right and wrong, but if you go to very strict materialists and naturalists, they would say right and wrong is not an objective value, but it's actually subjective and it's constructed by human beings. So as a society, we decide what is right and wrong, and we kind of have cultural norms for that, and that's basically the way that we understand what right and wrong is. It has just evolved over the millions and billions of years, so to say. As Christians, we have a very different idea, and so you can pursue this question like, would it actually help human flourishing better to have an absolute idea of right and wrong, as we as Christians have, or to have like a subjective idea of right and wrong? Now, that is a very simple, it's not a simple question, but like you can go much deeper and kind of develop the question a lot deeper and expose some of the inconsistencies there and help people to see how it actually makes much more sense for human flourishing and to have like a transcendent understanding of right and wrong than to have an immanent, like and constructed sense of right and wrong. The other thing here with ethics is like behaving ethically, right? That's another opportunity for Christians to kind of show, instead of tell, it's kind of show and tell, but to show that you're a Christian, and so kind of to invoke some of the questions. But it's more an integration of faith and learning on a kind of like a character level than it's on a content level. Another big question is soteriology. Soteriology in Christian circles would be like, how are we saved? In a kind of a more academic context, it would be, what is the solution to our problems? So we have lots and lots of problems that we're facing, right? And so what does your field, your academic discipline, say about like what's the solution to all those different kind of problems? And what could the Christian faith contribute to that? That's a really interesting question, especially with all the problems that we're the problems are not bigger now. It feels sometimes that we have more problems. I think every time has its own problems, but like for us as Christians to kind of think about it and speak into those areas of soteriology, what is the solution to our problems? I think Christianity has something to say there. Two more. Epistemology. How do we know what we know? Big things. Because the epistemology is deeply influenced by what you actually believe about the deepest sense of reality. So for example, in a materialistic universe, if you only believe that there's no God, that there's nothing transcendent beyond this, then it becomes kind of principles, material principles, and that kind of like give you an idea of what this world is. And so impersonal material principles, so the laws of physics and matter and those different kind of things. It actually becomes really difficult to build anything beyond that, so to build an ethics on there, to build an epistemology on there. People do it, but the consequences of something like that, as some people have actually pointed out, lead to kind of like a meaningless and a purposelessness. And so you kind of like can explore those, like the inconsistencies in those different kind of things. For Christians, right, our epistemology, the difficulty for us as Christians is that our epistemology often is also just a secular epistemology, especially if you're in a field, in an academic field, that's what you're being taught. So how do you know in sociology? Well, my professor taught me how I should know in sociology, right? Or my teacher at a high school taught me how I should know those kind of things. And often those are actually secular epistemologies, yeah? But God doesn't play a role into that. So how then, as a Christian, do you basically have to work really, really hard to bring your epistemology together with your Christian faith and to actually develop an epistemology that's deeply informed by your Christian faith, and then through that epistemology think through the big questions in your field. That's actually not easy. So for me as a physicist, I've trained at a secular university, like the way that I think about this universe was just totally materialistic. And it wasn't until I was a graduate student, late graduate student, that I realized I actually had to change my epistemology. And it was actually thinking about the resurrection. Why the resurrection? Now, one of the things, like as a physicist, right, the resurrection cannot happen. It doesn't happen. Like human beings, once they're dead, don't come back to life again because it's just matter, right? And so that was when I came out of my period of doubt, and a couple of years later, that I realized that I never had really dealt with that in a very deep sense, philosophical, theological sense, and I realized that I changed my worldview. Basically in such a way that I had to say, like, actually, the resurrection changes everything, the way I think about this reality, because dead people actually do become alive again, which is totally in contradiction with what science teaches. And so I had to rethink science from the ground up, like, where does the resurrection and where does this idea of, like, a universe that's both transcendent and, and kind of material, so to say, and that, like, dead beings can come alive again, so to say, where does it influence other things and other beliefs that I held initially, and how do I need to change that? And that was kind of a journey for me in kind of like epistemology. I can tell more about it later if you want, because that's a long journey. But epistemology, how do we know what we know? And is our knowing influenced by Christian ideas, or is our knowing influenced, for many people, just by secular ideas? Last one, eschatology, what's the end game? To what ends? And what kind of story does your field tell? Every field, every discipline tells a certain story. Where we come from, where we're going, what the problem is, what the solution is. And so this is kind of what often gives meaning kind of to what we do, right? So kind of like the end game gives meaning to what we are as Christians, why we are here in this world, that we eventually will be living with God, will we see God, and we basically find a full fulfillment in God again. So eschatology often provides meaning and purpose for a lot of different kind of things. And it's the same for disciplines as well. And so what is the story that, like, sociology tells, or a certain theory in sociology tells about, like, where are we going? Now, one of the things that you'll find a lot in contemporary kind of like academia is a story of progress, right? That's primarily in the sciences, where we become better and better and better. There's more and more and more improvements, technological advances, and we understand, like, we can even build kind of devices into ourselves and all these different kind of things. So there's a story of progress. In the social sciences, it's not always a story of progress. It's sometimes a story of regress. But it tells a little bit, like, what is kind of like the long vision that the field has, and how can a Christian speak into those different kind of things?